Yea, verily, this is the Lord your God. I don't exist, and you are listening to the San Diego Seculars for Wednesday, September 26, 2012.
Thanks, Not God. This is Jason Fry, the president of the Humanist Association of San Diego, and I want to welcome you back to our new podcast. I think this is our fourth one we're putting out, and this is going to be a quick one. I know I said the last one was going to be quick, but people were also asking for me to record the lecture, and I recorded last week's lecture. And so this one is primarily just going to be news for this week and some thoughts on a couple ethical issues. I want to say I hope you're all doing well, and let's get started. So I want to talk a little bit about the news this week. Like I said, this is going to be a rather short one. I'm really busy right now trying to find a job and trying to do a few other things. And so I don't have any time to edit this, but because I'm getting requests to do more podcasts, I hope this turns out just fine. And I went to the wonderful talk at the San Diego Association for Rational Inquiry on debunking UFOs last Sunday, and people brought up the podcast, and people wanted to discuss what I had said in the last one. So I know you guys are listening, and I know we have a small audience so far, and I hope that that expands. So I guess this will be a short one, and we'll see where it goes. Next one is going to be a bit longer. I think I'm going to also incorporate the book club into what we're doing, and a review of Ray Comfort and his pizza party with the secular community in San Diego that's coming up this coming weekend. And I'll tell you about that as this program commences. So to start off, it came out from Harvard University that a Harvard Divinity Scholar by the name of Karen L. King looked over a 4th century Coptic papyrus, and in broken phrases, the Coptic papyrus said, this apparently was from Jesus, it said, "Not to me, my mother gave me life." The disciples said to Jesus, "Deny, Mary is worthy of it." Jesus said to them, "My wife, ... she will be able to be my disciple. Let wicked people swell up. As for me, I dwell with her in order to an image." It's rather broken up, but a lot of people out there are talking about this, saying, "Oh, Jesus had a wife." Well, you know, I have to say one thing about that. We look at the history of the Christian God, which is the same God as the Muslim God, if we're talking in that all people, the book context. And if we look at that, we go back, we have El Shaddai, the god of the mountain, who is a Ugaritic god, and he had a wife, he had a consort, the Asherah, he had a son and daughter, Baal, Astarte, and also some people say Yahweh was one of the sons of El. And so if God had a girlfriend and a wife, is it any surprise that the son was a little bit of a chip off the old Trinity? And so, I don't know. What do you guys think about this? And I wonder how much money Dan Brown is going to make off of this by people saying, "Oh, the Divinity Code was right." And I don't know. So what do you guys think about this? And speaking of the Jesus issue, in Spain, there was a 19th century fresco called the Ecce Homo, Behold the Man, and an octogenarian woman came forth by the name of Cecilia Jimenez, and she offered to help restore the painting. Well, what came out of that, and you've probably seen this, is a very distorted image of Christ. And the family of the artist who painted this in the 19th century came forth threatening to sue Senora Jimenez because she distorted the artwork. Well, it turns out that in the church that this particular Ecce Homo is in, it's gained such wide popularity that the church has had to hire security in order to protect the image. And it's become a huge tourist trap. Not only that, but Senora Jimenez is now asking for royalties because she apparently added such an increase of value to this particular piece of art. And I looked at some Facebook memes of this recently, and my favorite one, and soon I'll probably attach this to our website. We're going to update our website, sdhumanist.org, and I'm probably going to attach stuff that I look at while I talk about this podcast so you guys get to see what I look at, maybe some homework attached to it too to have you guys contribute. Well, looking at this distorted Christ figure that looks somewhat human, I saw a Facebook image that had votive candles, and one of the votive candles had this photoshopped in. And I thought it was pretty funny. So moving on to the separation of church and state, Jen Brewer, the governor of Arizona, signed a bill recently, HB 2563, which would ostensibly allow Bible classes as electives and its influence in Western society. And according to the text in HB 2563, a school district or charter school may offer an elective course pertaining to how the Bible has influenced Western culture for pupils in grades 9 through 12. A teacher who instructs a course offered under this section in its appropriate historical context and in good faith shall be immune from civil liability and disciplinary action. This bill, with Governor Brewer signing it into effect, has Arizona joining Georgia, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Texas in states that have public school exceptions to teach the Bible as literature. And, you know, in a sense, I think it's interesting. I sort of have my own ideas about posting Decalogues in schools. You know, we post the Ten Commandments. I think that some people try to post the Ten Commandments. I say there's a better Decalogue, the Bill of Rights. You know, Ten Commandments are things that you must not do, but the Bill of Rights are things the government must not do to you. And then we also have this whole idea of putting disclaimer stickers on textbooks, biology textbooks, when they teach evolution in certain school districts. And I think this is really interesting because they say we need to teach the controversy. And I think in a way it might be good to teach creationism, but teach it as an example of bad science, or I should say intelligent design, which essentially is agendized biblicism, and it goes towards the Abrahamic context. We don't talk about turtle on top of turtle on top of turtle, or we don't talk of an Inuit mythology that say we came from dog droppings, even though, you know, some people might not act much higher than that. And at the same time, I think if we do this, we should show this, not because these Bible characters serve as sufficient role models, but because they serve as cautionary tales. We see the worst of human behavior and the worst of human personality being celebrated in biblical text. And I think that if we're going to be doing this, as long as we're placing disclaimer stickers on biology books saying evolution is just a theory, why not place these disclaimer stickers on the Bible? And perhaps teaching this stuff will be good because kids will see through it, because kids are smart. And I don't know. What do you guys think about this? I think that if we put it out there, it's a good cautionary tale. But at the same time, the reason people are trying to push this through is not ostensibly not to broaden the mindset about where Western culture came from, but to promote biblicism, to promote a Christian agenda, to try to legitimate the theology through public school education. It's bad enough that they try to strive for vouchers to take funds absolutely necessary for public schools to put it towards religious education, that now they're putting the Bible, quote unquote, back in the classroom, and they're trying, I don't know. I'm just kind of interested in this, and I'm sort of disappointed by this, but not necessarily surprised. What do you guys think? Connect with us on Facebook, Humanist Association of San Diego, or email us at humanistsd, like humanistsandiego, at gmail.com. Let us know what you think. And soon, like I said, I'll post some of these articles on the website. Soon I'm going to be posting everything we do at Coffee and Conversation. That way, if you can't attend, you can definitely participate. And on top of that, hopefully if you live too far away to attend, then you can start one of your own. It would be great to have a broader discussion based upon the work that we do at the Humanist Association. Secondly, there was a conference call of evangelicals a week ago, and Texas Governor Rick Perry, the guy who took state funds to pray for rain, came out saying that Satan runs across the world with his doubt and his untruths. And what have you and one of the untruths out there that is driven is that the people of faith should not be involved in the public arena. And I copy and pasted from an article on this. And Perry said during the call on Tuesday, organized by Reverend Rick Scarborough, somehow or another, there's this, you know, steel wall, this iron curtain or whatever you want to call it, between the church and the people of faith, and the separation of church and state is just false on its face. We have a biblical responsibility to be involved in the public arena proclaiming God's truth. You think about this spiritual warfare that's going on and going strong as President Obama and his cronies in Washington continue their efforts to remove any trace of religion from American life. And it falls on us. I mean, we truly are Christian warriors, Christian soldiers, and for one of us as Americans to stand our ground and to firmly send a message to Washington that our nation is about more than just some secular laws. And, you know, I don't mean to disparage people with a Southern accent, but I mean, honestly, it tends to be that the greater, there's an inverse relationship between the deeper the draw and the higher the intelligence out there. And I know there's a lot of people out there who are smart with Southern accents, but please step up and be a louder voice, because these idiots are making you look bad. And I was just reading off this verbatim quote, and I was screwing up trying to read what Rick Perry said. It's kind of like Michael Jordan. I'm a well-articulate speaker, and it's like Michael Jordan trying to miss a free throw. Anyway, maybe I should be the governor of Texas, even though it's pretty much an empty figurehead position, and the lieutenant governor has much more power. Anyway, moving forward, right. So in the Amish community, there is a breakaway sect led by Sam Mullet Sr., and Sam Mullet Sr. and 15 others were convicted for cutting the beards and hair of their former associates. And in the Amish faith, men can't cut their beards and women aren't allowed to cut their hair. And they are being charged with religious hate crimes, but at the same time, it should also be seen as a family feud. Anyway, I'm going to skip through this part real quick, move on to some other things. I think this is also interesting, too. Something happened in Saudi Arabia. The Saudi labor ministry ordered the closure of 100 Riyadh lingerie shops that had male staffers. It closed them down on a violation of a decree because a decree of feminization and nationalization of jobs to make the workplace safe for women. And some things that have happened in the region recently, the kingdom has decided to build up several all-women communities because it's something to the effect of 61% of women have college degrees, 78% of women are unemployed, and 15% of the people in the workforce in Saudi Arabia are women. And they are stuck with this bullshit Arab tribalist idea of women's quote-unquote modesty, having to conceal themselves from men that they're not intimately related to. So what Saudi Arabia is trying to do is create these women-only environments in order to put women into the workforce. And I kind of think that this is this might lead to something good, because we see in society when women get financial power and it tends to lead towards civil freedom when they have economic influence. And, you know, hopefully this leads to something good. But on top of that, there's this whole idea of a new machismo going through the area. For example, Hemas, the Harakat al Muslawama al-Islamiyah. I can't remember the exact acronym, but Hamas is an acronym for the Islamic Resistance Movement. And the Islamic Resistance Movement recently closed down all male hairdressers in the Gaza Strip. Hamas also banned women from smoking in cafes, saying that it would sully the image of Palestinians. And so, I don't know, I guess this is taking Frederick out of Frederick's of Riyadh. And we'll see what's happening. So I guess in Iran, there are no gays in Iran, and they're trying to take jobs away from us in Saudi Arabia, I guess. Anyway, moving on to the next one, politics. Let's see. All right. No politics this week. But then I wanted to call this one more cluster flux. This is what this is kind of the convergence of what I call pernicious piety and politics. And this is more about the Benghazi situation and Cairo and Tunis. So it came out that Hillary Clinton came out saying that this was an al-Qaeda attack. Also, the Egyptian Prime Minister Hesham Kandil came out saying that a bunch of the protesters in Cairo were paid. The U.S. is investigating whether the Benghazi protesters had inside help. And it turns out that this, unlike what Obama is putting this out to be, which is strictly about the video, it's more than that. And like I've been saying, this is a release of the steam valve. The current governments that have come in and replaced the old governments in these countries, they're not doing so well. So they're focusing on Americans, especially the American government, when it was a Coptic Egyptian expatriate that created the film Innocence of Muslims. And on top of that, There's some things that I think about this, and the things I think about this are we are conflating certain issues. When we talk about the video, people are prefacing it way too strongly. They're being too loud in volume by saying, oh, it's an asshole who made this, or it's an awful, awful, ridiculous film. It should never have been made. But that's not what this is really about, I don't think. It's not about the quality of the film. It's about the fact that someone made something unpopular, and we need to stand up for that person's right to express it. The person who made the film was not talking specifically about Muslims today, I don't think. He was talking about Muhammad. And I watched a YouTube clip recently, and it was Sean Faircloth of the Richard Dawkins Foundation. And Sean was saying what I've been saying also. And this needs to be expressed more than the idea it's just the film that's caused violence. Well, A, no film merits any kind of violent action against anybody. No film merits violent action against anybody like this. You know, there's differences when it comes to things like child porn, granted. But things like this, this does not merit violence. And the fact of the matter is we should hold the people who are exhibiting violence to the standard of rational human beings and say no, and you need to be appropriately handled for this. But at the same time, Sean brought up how Obama's saying how it's terrible to denigrate religion in any manner. And then Sean brought up the fact that sometimes truth is a defense. What if the truth is denigrating to those who have sentiments towards these religious ideas? What then? Because in terms of libel and slander, the truth is a defense. And what if this had some element of truth to it? And on top of that, I'm just blown away by this and how much we are doing the wrong thing again, which is slamming somebody who made a piece of critical expression, no matter how tasteless, no matter how accurate or inaccurate. And we need to stand up for the rights of free speech. That is the fundamental right that we cherish. And I started reading Irshad Manji's All Love and Liberty again, and she talks heavily on culture. And she's Muslim. She's an open lesbian, progressive Muslim activist. And I like her. I really like her. I would say that the world would be a better place if all Muslims were like her. I would even call her a religious humanist. She focuses on the happiness of people in the here and now, and she attributes that her God created human beings with our happiness and contentment in mind. And I think that if we can't just have all atheistic secular humanist, you know, I would rather have a bunch of ethical religious humanists than a bunch of unethical, selfish, non-humanistic atheists, because the whole point is that we are pro-social animals and we are driven to care about each other. And even if we try not to, biology confounds that. And I'm going to talk about that when I come to empathy. But Irshad Manji was writing about this in her book, All Love and Liberty, and she's talking about culture and she's criticizing supremacy. And she says that supremacy, these forms of supremacy, are an act of war against the true composite nature of ourselves. She also slams Arab culture. She says that Islam came to raise the people out of Arab culture, and in the end, Arab culture conquered Islam. Like I said before, I don't necessarily agree with her completely. I kind of think it's a little Pollyanna-ish idea of Islam, but you know, this whole idea that it's these cultural considerations which weigh with such a heavy weight upon these issues that we need to talk about them too. And she writes that culture changes and culture is a product of human expression, and human dignity and human life is worth more than protecting culture. And we need to rise above these naive attributions of cultural relativism, of moral relativism. And when we ask questions about culture, and I agree with her on this, when we ask questions of culture and we criticize culture, what we should be asking is, how does that culture treat the weaker and less influential members of its society? And if it treats it with such a division, with a heavy weight of opprobrium on action or existence for the weaker or less influential members of society, as human beings, global citizen human beings, it is contingent upon us to stand up and say, hey, wait a minute, and be a voice for the defenseless, and stand up for reason, and say, well, we don't know if there's a God, but we know there are people. And we know that people are being mistreated by this. And though you may not like what this person is having to say, it does not merit killing other people over it. And like Hillary Clinton said, and I really like what Hillary Clinton said. I thought what she said was absolutely fantastic. What Hillary Clinton said, she said, it does not honor your religion to kill people over offense. And so, I don't know, I'm thinking more about this. And, of course, we have Salman Rushdie, who's coming out with his book, Joseph Antoine, A Memoir. And he was interviewed all over the place. One place he was interviewed was the BBC. And Salman Rushdie said on the Satanic Verses that it would probably not be published today, citing, the outrage industry. And he said that the death threats he received from the Satanic Verses publication gave him a long-term chilling effect. And it also has to be noted that the fatwa is still on his head for publishing the Satanic Verses. And why are they called the Satanic Verses? Everyone says the Satanic Verses. Well, here's what the Satanic Verses are. So the original Satanic Verses come from a time when apparently Muhammad was dictating more pluralistic texts, more pluralistic scripture. And when Muhammad received more power, the type of pluralism that was put out to get along with the neighbors, that went out the window. And it was said that Muhammad was being influenced by Satan. They struck those verses out and they were called the Satanic Verses. Well, what Salman Rushdie did is he wrote a novel based loosely on that. And the idea was a scribe was a Muhammad-like prophet had a scribe, and that scribe started changing little things and then started changing big things and more, and the quote-unquote prophet didn't catch on to it. And we say prophet, but we haven't found any conclusive evidence to promote the idea of connection to some kind of spiritual intercessory telepathic entity, and we haven't found any conclusive evidence leading towards psychic phenomenon being accurate. And so I think Thomas Paine said it best in the Age of Reason, then when we look at the word prophet, what we're talking about is poet. Because all the prophets in the Old Testament and the Torah, they were really poets. So I guess we should say the poet Muhammad. And I don't know. And at the same time, it just strikes me that anyone today who claims that they have some kind of intellectual decoder ring connection to the Almighty is considered schizophrenic and crazy. And we would apply that across the board, but we don't apply it retroactively. And just because those people who claimed or had it attributed those type of telepathic connections, they're considered prophetic ad popularum. It's a fallacy, and we need to think about this. Well, would it pass the smell test today? Well, anyway, Salman Rushdie published this book, The Satanic Verses. And he gave an interview about the whole situation with the film The Innocence of Muslims today and everything that's happened since he published it in 1988. And he said further to the BBC, if you look at the way in which free expression is being attacked by religious extremism, the things of which these people are accused is always the same. It's blasphemy, heresy, insult, offense. It's this medieval vocabulary. Some of them seem to accept the free speech argument and understood if they had the right to say what they felt, it was wrong to prevent people who felt differently from having their say. He said that to the BBC. And then, of course, after this, French embassies received protest because a French satire magazine, Charlie Hebdo, released its own Mohammed cartoons. And in protest of that, a French Muslim convert was sentenced to 3 months in jail for carrying a weapon at a protest outside of a Parisian U.S. embassy. That was probably because of the Benghazi thing, not the Charlie Hebdo. And on top of that, an assailant threw a grenade into a Paris kosher store. But it's really interesting because there's all sorts of expression that can be treasured, whether it's distasteful or tasteful. And something interesting, and I would say I would go to see this exhibit, because we have religious art, and we have to remember that we may not agree with the patron of the religious art or the inspiration of the religious art per se. We may not agree in the truth of that. There's a lot of beauty in a lot of religious art. And the Louvre recently opened a Saudi-funded Muslim art wing, and I would be really interested to go see that. And, you know, though we may dislike some of it, part of being a human being, and especially being a humanist, is we have this big tradition of good and bad ideas and beautiful and horrific art. And we should look at it, get examples from it, learn from our mistakes. And what I always say is humanism is what has happened when we look at history and not only realize that we were the author, but we look forward realizing that we hold the pen. And all these things are part of the canon of the human experience. And on top of that, Sam Harris wrote an essay on the situation. And looking at this, one of my favorite stories that came out this week, similar in line with this, but slightly outside of that, there was an Iranian cleric who had the shit beat out of him by a woman up in the Semnan province in northern Iran, and the cleric had ordered her to cover up. He said that she was improperly covered. And this is really interesting because he had continually badgered her, cover yourself, cover yourself. And she replied to him, you cover up your own eyes. And then he ordered her to cover herself up again. And apparently she went over, started beating him. And in the article I found, the quote from this this imam by the name of Beheshti, he said, I fell on my back on the floor. I don't know what happened after that. All I could feel was the kicks of this woman who was insulting me and attacking me. So he was harassing her, and yet he was the one who was insulted. That's the thing about the custodians of the Abrahamic monotheisms and fundamentalist forms, is they have the sense of entitlement, not equality. They have the sense of elevation, not uplifting. And it's always an insult to them. They can do whatever the hell they want. They can say whatever the hell they want. But the moment that you express yourself and you assert yourself on an equal moral playing field, and that you don't necessarily accept the level of intrusion of the God that they've intruded upon you and its dictates on the same level that they appreciate it, then they have a problem. It's an insult to them. And yet what baffles me, what just drives me insane, is the fact that they proclaim these things as truths. And when they proclaim these things as truths, if it's a truth, it should be a truth for everybody. And yet when someone disagrees, if they disagree in a sophomoric fashion or even a completely sophisticated fashion, they're always considered rude. Not the person imposing it. Not the person who doesn't have the burden of proof. But, I don't know, one example of this from my own experience was I was trying to study at UCI, University of California, Irvine, and I was going all over the place and I kept getting interrupted. And it was really interesting because I was taking Joseph McKenna's History of Atheism class, and I was reading some of the texts. I was actually reading Chapman Cohn's essay on the devil, the question that asked, why are there no statues of Lucifer in Christian temples? Why are there no statues of Lucifer in Christian temples? Because Satan's responsible for the entire thing. Satan's responsible for the fall of man. We wouldn't have people without Satan. We wouldn't have Christianity without Satan tempting Jesus. We wouldn't have all of that. So we owe a great debt to Satan. On top of that, Satan brought us wisdom. If you believe in Satan, Satan was essentially the Christian Prometheus. He stole fire from the gods. He told us to go eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And so I'm reading on the devil, and then I'm sitting there, and then a couple people came up sitting to ask if they could sit near me, and I said sure, and they said, well, can we play guitar? And I said, sure. I expected them kind of like keep to themselves. But then they started playing really loud and they started singing Christian evangelical praise and worship songs. And it was weird because, you know, I would suggest that don't invent harmony if you can't get the melody, because you won't even have a chance in hell of getting harmony right. But, you know, I put on my headphones and I couldn't even focus because they were so loud and they were so off pitch. But, you know, free country and all. So I went to Starbucks. And UCI, for some reason, has a lot of evangelicals and has a lot of people promoting Christianity and Islam. And, you know, just go take a couple of the science classes, go take a couple of the philosophy classes, think a little bit more than imparting. And so I'm sitting there at Starbucks and a woman comes up to me and she asks if I've ever heard of Jesus Christ. And I think, I'm a white guy at a major university. I speak English. I'm probably from here, so asking me if I've ever heard of Jesus is like asking me if I've ever heard of Ronald McDonald, Ronald Reagan, or Santa Claus. And I say, why, yes. And she said, well, do you believe in him? She had an English accent. She was an older woman. She was probably one of the Jehovah's Witnesses who's always sitting there on Ring Road. And I said, no. And then she said, well, why not? And then I just gave her this long explanation about Eusebius and Origen and the transfer of the works of Josephus and the ideas that if there was a Jesus, it was a composite of different characters, yada, yada, yada. And then she just started yelling at me, said, well, you're going to hell. And my thought was, well, fuck, you just asked me if, you know, what my opinion was. Thank you so much, Letty. Keep up the good Christian charity. And I have a lot of good Christian friends who don't do that, who don't impose. We share ideas. And I like that. I like that idea of not imposing, but sharing ideas and working on ideas together. Well, anyway, I guess I'm rambling at this point. But I just see this. I see this as just, look at this. What did Beheshti say? He said, I could feel were the kicks of this woman who was insulting me and attacking me. Well, you know, open your eyes. Stop being so solipsistic. And this doesn't necessarily apply so much to Islam, though Jesus is considered a prophet in Islam. But didn't Jesus say something in effect of, don't criticize your neighbor for the plank in their eye for the speck in your own or something like that. But I don't know. Anyway, rambling at this point, I'm putting out a podcast for you guys because you really want one. And some LGBT news. So I am starting a local chapter of the LGBT Humanist Council, the American Humanist Association in San Diego. I popped up a meetup page on this. Look on meetup.com for LGBT Humanist Council San Diego or LGBT Humanist in 92104 zip code on meetup.com. Well, a few cool things happened. So as we all know, the Boy Scouts of America has continued its exclusion of LGBT people. And Intel, the tech company Intel, gave $700,000 to local Boy Scout of America clubs in 2010. And Intel announced that it is no longer going to continue the practice because of its discrimination. Well, one thing that has to be brought up, because we talk about the Boy Scouts and discrimination against LGBT people, well, the Boy Scouts also discriminate against humanists and atheists. And no one's talking about that necessarily. And Obama came out condemning or disagreeing, not necessarily condemning, but disagreeing with the Boy Scouts policy, despite the fact that he is the honorary president of the Boy Scouts of America. Nothing was said about non-believing Americans or disbelieving Americans. On top of that, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was giving a lecture at the University of Colorado. And she was asked a question, the justice was asked a question about equal protection and LGBT rights. And her comment was that she would like to answer, but she's not allowed, that the justices don't typically respond to upcoming cases. So it's thought that the Defense of Marriage Act is going to be definitely heard by the court. But I forgot exactly when they're going to conference on this, but it'll probably pop up and we'll see it next year. And I'm looking with bated breath towards that. On top of that, Chick-fil-A promised to no longer fund traditional marriage, but apparently it's still going to do that by some loopholes. And the day that it announced that it's no longer going to fund quote-unquote traditional marriage campaigns, Jennifer Brower and I went to Chick-fil-A, and I have to say I thought the sandwich was shit, but the side salad was good. I had a sip of Jennifer's peach milkshake. That was pretty good, but honestly, maybe I had a bad sandwich that day, but it was really dry. The pickle was the only redeeming quality, and KFC has much better chicken sandwiches. I'm trying not to eat as much fast food. I'm trying to lose weight, but I would say if you guys had a choice between KFC and Chick-fil-A, go to the Colonel. The Colonel's 13 herbs and spices don't discriminate on people on the basis of sexual orientation or gender orientation or gender identity. And then UCLA Law School came out with a one-year study saying there were no aggregate negative effects from the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And the AHA, the American Humanist Association, is asking us to ask our legislators to oppose the Military Religious Freedom Act, which would allow chaplains to ignore the needs of open gay, lesbian, and bisexual service members. So then, lastly, we talked about the Ten Commitments again. The Ten Commitments, of course, is the COCHAR Humanist Education System's look at ethics. And I'm looking into this, and I had a good email exchange with Bob Bierman, the director of the COCHAR system, and I'm going to be sending him what we talk about, my notes on that. And soon I'm going to expand this to a sort of monthly meeting where we talk about an ethical issue once a month. And of course, the Ten Commitments again: altruism, environmental stewardship, critical thinking, empathy, ethical development, global awareness, human rights, peace and social justice, responsibility, service and participation. And what I keep saying, I like commitment rather than commandment. Commitment has personal responsibility. Commandment is an imposition. Personal responsibility has an obligation to it. Commandment is an imposition where you're not necessarily obliged to obey, but a commitment is a self-obligated action. And I like this, and I like where this leads, and I like that all of these ideas would be good for religious humanists and secular humanists. Not to say that religious humanists aren't necessarily secular humanists, but secular humanists, of course, typically have the idea of non-theism and promoting this idea of a non-theistic universe attached to it. And so we talked about altruism 1 week. And we talked about game theory. We talked about some biology involved with that. And I keep posting an image of Mr. Rogers sitting on a school bus, the steps of a school bus, with the trolley in his lap. And Mr. Rogers, of course, was a Presbyterian minister, but he didn't impose his religious beliefs on the kids. He just helped kids feel good about themselves. And this was great. This was what was necessary for a latchkey generation. And I don't know, I grew up with Mr. Rogers, and maybe Lady Elaine Fairchild turned me gay or something because she was fabulous. Anyway, so this picture of Mr. Rogers that I've shown every week, and people like it every week, it just makes me happy and makes me feel good. And it says, and this is a quote from Fred Rogers, "We live in a world in which we need to share responsibility. It's easy to say, it's not my child, it's not my community, not my world, not my problem. Then there are those who see the need and respond. I consider those people my heroes." I really like that. Then we talked about environmental stewardship, as the COCHAR system calls it, and the Ten Commitments, caring for the world around us. We talked about critical thought. And it was really cool. A friend of mine teaches at San Diego City College, and I was talking with him about critical thought, and he asked if I could come in and give a lecture on critical thought, and I did. And then he said, "Can you come and be a guest speaker in another one of my classes?" So that was pretty cool. I had fun talking at City College. I need to be a professor. I would love to be a professor. Just got to get into grad school. So if any of you listening out there are professors and you like what I have to say, I don't, I'm not attached to any institution at the moment, and I would gladly sit at the feet of the master and become a much better scholar. And anyway, so we talked about empathy. And I looked into Franz de Waal's book, The Age of Empathy, Nature's Lessons for a Kinder Society. Dr. de Waal, the Dutch primatologist, or is he Danish? I forget. I think he's Danish, actually. I might be Baltic dyslexic or something, but amazing scholar, brilliant scholar. Actually, next year he's coming out with a book, The Atheist and the Bonobo, Looking for Humanism in the Animal Kingdom. And oh my God, I can't wait for that to come out. I love this book. This book is so incredible. I give this book like 15 opposable thumbs up. I say that because he's a primatologist. But looking at it, what the Ten Commitments said on this was, we human beings are capable of empathy, the ability to understand and enter imaginatively into another living being's feelings, the sad ones and the happy ones as well. Many of the personal relationships we have in the family, among friends, between diverse individuals and amid other living things are made positive through empathy. Is my bag there? Okay. I'll put all my notes online after this eventually. With discussion and role-playing, we can learn how other people feel when they are sad or hurt or ignored, as well as when they experience great joys. We can use stories, anecdotes, and classroom events to help us nurture sensitivity to how our actions impact others. And so looking at this, empathy, defined as the ability to recognize emotions and sensations being experienced by other sentient beings. And of course, empathia in Greek is passions. And the German, I like the German better, Einfühlung, which means feeling into. It's a theory of mind. And I don't know. I think that we need to talk about empathy. I think empathy is crucial. I think we are driven to empathy, and we need to discuss these issues. And so in The Age of Empathy, Franz de Waal talks about the biological drive towards pro-social behavior. He talks about neurology. He talks about mirror neurons. He talks about von Economo neurons, Venn cells. And he looks into our closest relatives. He looks into chimps and bonobos. And he looks into what he called emotional contagions, yawns. And he talked about these things. He talked about there is competition and there are terrible things that happen. And I think it was particularly profound when he said that it's questioned whether or not chimps have empathy because they're hostile to each other, but we don't question that in ourselves. He also brings up the idea that when we talk about biology, why is it always looked about in a negative context? He also talks about Darwinism and Spencer's social Darwinism that was in vogue for a while. And I don't know. He talks about our nature and our truly pro-social nature. He talks about when you see people walking together, soon they're walking within stride. On top of that, we have yawn, where we yawn together. And I'll talk about this more in the future, but I just found this book incredibly stirring, incredibly thought-provoking, and something to aspire to. It's more along the lines of E.O. Wilson than Richard Dawkins. I think Richard Dawkins is a little too much into the Spencerian idea of social Darwinism and competition. And I like Wilson's idea of social cooperation and aspirational altruism. And I don't know, what do you guys think about this? And I think I'm going to wrap up in a second, but I want to tell you about some things we're doing. And I want to give you some information on what we're doing soon and how to get in touch with us. And so, like I said, I probably won't have time to update this. I'm probably going to turn this into a different file format and upload it immediately after and post it because I know you guys are asking for it. And soon, hopefully very soon, I'm going to be able to spread some of the work I've been doing around with a bunch of our new people, our wonderful people in our group. And we're going to have a board meeting about this and I'll have more time to edit, or maybe you'll find a wonderful, wonderful human being who has better editing skills than I do who can, you know, polish this up pretty well. But this Saturday at the Creation Museum in Santee, California, there's a couple authors. I forget the name of one of them. He has a hypothesis that because certain archaeological things, such as friezes and that, and temple reliefs look like dinosaurs, and cultures have spoken about dragons across the planet, that human beings lived with dinosaurs, so therefore we have a new earth creation type of situation happening. And then we have Ray Comfort. Ray Comfort is speaking at the Creation Museum, and he offered to buy the secular community pizza. So come on down to the Creation Museum, I think it's at 3:00 for pizza with Ray Comfort. Following that, we have our weekly coffee and conversation, 1469 University Avenue, 6 p.m. Saturdays. It's a different show every week. Talk about current events. We talk about separation of church and state, politics, religious issues, ethical issues, science, LGBT health, that type of thing. Coming up for our third Sunday meeting in October, we have Pastor Dale Huell, sort of a non-Orthodox Baptist minister, who's going to tell us what's wrong with religion. And I'm looking forward to that. When Mickey gave his talk a couple months ago, he had Dale there, and Dale was absolutely fantastic. And I can't wait to see what Dale has to say for this. On top of that, our two book club meetings, one coming up next Tuesday, and then one 3 weeks from now, we have George William Foote's Prisoner for Blasphemy. That's first Tuesday of October at Bamboo Lounge, 1469 University. And then second one for the third Tuesday is Charles Bradlaugh's Freethinker's Textbook. And then November 11th, we have Edwina Rogers, the executive director of the Secular Coalition for America. We're going to have her at 11 a.m. The place will be announced soon. We're getting a venue. We'll let you know, but invite your friends. She's fantastic. And I know that she's going to be really well received. And she's brand new. She replaced Sean Faircloth in the last year or so. And I'm anxiously looking forward to seeing what she has to say. And then third Sunday in November, we are doing our annual Logical Fallacy Clinic. And then December, we have Human Light, hosted by atheist evangelist Sam Singleton. So, you know, I hope you can join us. And then also, we are promoting the weekly Ask an Atheist booth in Balboa Park. I believe it's over by the fountain, but check our meetup site for that. And it's not going to happen this Saturday because of the Ray Comfort thing. And then on October 7th, we have our board meeting. If you want the board to talk about anything, send us a message. And, you know, cool stuff coming up. Looking forward to hearing from you guys. Looking forward to seeing you guys at our upcoming meetings. Contact us, HumanistSD, that's Humanist San Diego, HumanistSD@gmail.com. Check us out on Meetup, Humanist Association of San Diego, Humanist Association of San Diego on Facebook. And yeah, just contact us. Let us know what you think of the podcast. Give us ideas. And come to one of our meetings. I think you'll enjoy them. So thank you again. This was fun recording it. And I'll have more time probably next week to edit the next podcast. But I do this for you guys. And thank you so much. And also one last commercial plug. It would be great to, because organizations live on donations, like organizations like ours live on donations. So please support us. Go to sdhumanist@gmail.com and hit our donate button. We need your help. And we have some cool speakers next year. And yeah, so I guess I'll sign off now. Yours in Humanism. Thank you for joining us. And this has been a production of the Humanist Association of San Diego.